Hello and welcome to Insight Global Economy Podcast. My name is Oscar Guinea. I'm a senior economist at Insight and I will be your host today. My guest is Lucien Cernat. Lucien is the chief trade economist at the European Commission. He has worked on many topics and we will be covering some of them today. For full disclosure, Lucien was my boss when I was a young intern at the chief economist unit, and we have continued working together, writing a paper with Daf Gerard and Lorenzo Isella on the consumer benefits of the EU trade liberalization. And we have recently published a new blog in Insight on the vulnerability of EU supply chains and the role of small and medium enterprises, titled On Ants, Dinosaurs, and How to Survive a Trade Apocalypse. Lucien, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Oscar. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be part of the Insight podcast, particularly these days when the kind of things we're going to discuss are extremely relevant and in the minds of many people.
Fantastic. Thank you, Lucien, for being with us. Let me start with a question. 10 years ago, there were little evidence about which companies really engage in international trade. And there was a growing perception that a few large multinationals were the only ones benefiting from trade deals. But in 2013, you published a paper that challenged that growing perception. What did you discover in that paper?
Well, thank you. You start with one of the most important things that I think I did throughout my career as a chief economist. In fact, before we begin, perhaps it's important for me to mention two things as well. In full disclosure, one is the usual disclaimer. I would like to indicate very clearly that everything I'm going to say today, these are personal opinions and they do not necessarily reflect an official position from the European Commission. So that's one thing. I'm glad I put it behind me so that it covers everything we're going to discuss. The other thing I wanted to also mention is that the invitation, Oscar, for today's podcast couldn't be timed any better because it's my last day as chief economist and I will start a new job soon. So it's a perfect occasion to look back at the last 10 years as a chief economist and see what happened during those years in terms of trade policy making and what kind of analysis we did to support that policy making, myself and my excellent team that I had throughout this period. So you touch upon a very important element, since remember 2013, that was when we were negotiating the TTIP. Many people may still remember that at the time the EU and the US were like-minded and very keen to have a 21st century free trade agreement. However, at the time there were also many people who were doubtful about the value of that agreement, and one misconception was that such an agreement will only benefit a few multinationals. And I think that was one of the first things we tried to do to confront misconceptions with real data. So I was lucky enough to find in Eurostat a database which allowed us to identify if trade is actually governed and dominated by a few large multinationals or also by smaller firms. And with the help of that database, for the first time, I think, in a very policy-relevant manner, we managed to demonstrate that in reality, SMEs, small and medium enterprises, are far more important than we think. They are basically, and we recently updated that analysis, they basically generate around one third of EU trade, and they dominate the number of firms that engage in trade. Over 80% of all the European firms engaged in trade are actually small firms, not multinationals. So it was, in a way, a game changer to make people pause and say, well, in general, trade policy does not benefit to a disproportionate extent a few firms. But quite the contrary, we have over 600,000 small firms engaged in trade. And for them, trade policy is essential for their success, for their competitiveness globally, and also for their workers. Since in another paper, we demonstrated that firms engaged in trade can afford to pay a wage premium.
This is indeed a major shift in the way people think about the impact of international trade policy. So you have also done work on calculating the number of European jobs that depend on international trade, and you have brought consumers into the picture as well. Let me ask you, what have you found doing that research, and also why it is important?
Well, again, I think a lot of the things we tried to do in the chief economist team at DigiTrade was to respond to the critical issues that policymakers were facing at the time. So I gave you the example of the small and medium enterprises, which was critical in the debate surrounding the TTIP negotiations. Go back to 2015 and you will see that there was a lot of interest in trade policy as a driver for economic prosperity. There was a lot of anxiety about jobs and also income inequality. So we, again, wanted to use all the data at our disposal to engage in that policy debate. So in that context, we wanted to really associate trade flows with the jobs behind all the containers that travel around the world to reach the final consumers. And luckily, again, with the help of colleagues from the Joint Research Center at the European Commission, plus colleagues in Eurostat, plus our own analytical insights in DigiTrade, we managed to actually calculate the number of jobs in Europe supported by our exports. And it was a fascinating discovery to see that such a large number of jobs, even to my surprise, were actually dependent on our ability to remain competitive worldwide. The latest calculations we did shows that 36 million jobs in Europe depend on our ability to trade. Those SMEs and also large companies who successfully compete in international trade, they employ 36 million jobs. That's actually 1 out of 7 jobs in Europe. And as I said earlier, it's also extremely important. I think we did not make enough out of it, but in the current debate about income inequality, to know that if you have two firms, one exporting and the other one not exporting, to know that the one that is engaged in international trade can actually afford to pay a wage premium to their workers, I think this is a very powerful message.
It is indeed. And let me ask you, the number of jobs that depend on international trade over the years in Europe have been going up, down, or that have been continued steady over time?
It's a good question, and I should have mentioned it myself. It has increased significantly over time. I think we have 5 more million jobs, which were additional to these calculations throughout the last Commission mandate for a number of reasons, notably the increased in trade, the fact that many firms nowadays find it easier to engage in trade, including via digital trade, which is another important factor in the whole equation. But I think one should, if I may add one word of caution, one should not expect this number to go up indefinitely. And we can talk about it, the impact of technology and the way in which certain other factors beyond trade policy may affect the trade and jobs equation. But one thing is sure, for the foreseeable period, I think you cannot start a phrase about international trade and not end it with jobs.
It's very true. It's very true. And it's also a way to engage with the public as the value of imports or exports gets into some numbers that are difficult to relate. But jobs is something we can all relate to and has a kind of a positive aspect to it. During these 10 years, you have put forward a number of concepts, initiatives, you have measured things that were not measured before, you and your team. But one of the things you have introduced is the notion of trade policy 2.0. What is trade policy 2.0?
That's a good question. And I'm glad that you offer me the chance to probably explain it as well to our listeners today, in case they haven't come across it in other contexts. It's an idea, again, that was couched into a particular historical context, let's say. It's, I think, something that started to percolate in my head over time. It started more or less at the same time when we discovered that SMEs are far more important than we think. So that in itself says that at the end of the day, in order to understand trade policy, you have to pay attention to firm heterogeneity, to firm characteristics. In academia, that idea was not new. Actually, it was almost old, since from late 1990s, early 2000s, we had excellent papers describing the importance of firm characteristics for trade success. But in trade policy terms, that idea did not travel home. We weren't really thinking about trade policy with a firm level idea behind. At the time, trade policy was still a sort of macroeconomic issue. Sometimes you would look at it through a sectoral lens, especially for sensitive sectors. And there were exceptions, of course, like the very detailed micro analysis that we were doing for anti-dumping investigations, which technically are firm level kind of policy making. But then in 2014, I wrote this chief economist note entitled Trade Policy 2.0, and I wanted to make us policymakers and people in the policy domain aware of the advances in the academia about the importance of firm characteristics. So SMEs was one angle, but also the sheer fact that trade policy may have local implications. But that was 2014, a bunch of nice ideas, but without necessarily clear immediate policy test case in sight. But now let's fast forward to 2016. 2016 was not a particularly good year for trade agreements. Remember the original Trans-Pacific Partnership, TPP, it was ready to be ratified. And unfortunately, after, I think, 7 years or so to negotiate it, the Obama administration could not get the deal through Congress. 2016 is also the year when Britain voted in a non-binding referendum to leave the EU. So against that background of negative news, I'd say, in terms of international cooperation or integration efforts, here comes CETA, the EU-Canada FTA. And you probably remember still the stickers on our red lights in Brussels, which said stop CETA. Again, there were many, many societal groups which were concerned, and I don't dispute the fact that sometimes people need to be concerned and they should convey those concerns to us. But they were really probably also a bit misguided about the impact of CETA. Again, with the same TTIP angle, it will benefit multinationals and nobody else. It will ruin our economies. And therefore, I thought this is the perfect time to test the trade policy 2.0, the firm level policymaking idea I proposed. We anticipated a very bumpy road in the European Parliament for the ratification of the agreement. And then we decided to do something innovative. We decided to geolocalize, to identify, and then to geolocalize all European exporters to Canada, and then put them on a map, and then go to each and every MEP and say, Honorable MEP, you are from this region in Europe. Here's a fact sheet about the benefits that this agreement will bring to the region and the people who elected you. And by the way, in your region, we just identified 455 or 1,000 companies exporting to Canada. They face tariffs, they face all sorts of barriers, and this agreement will actually help their bottom line. They will help their sales, maybe they will hire more people. And to our surprise, that evidence did convince politicians. And at the end of the day, we had a comfortable majority in Parliament, and the CETA deal was voted by the European Parliament. Since then, what it became known as FTA comes to town has become a standard product in our communication strategies on the importance of trade. And we have been using this trade policy 2.0 firm level driven communication and policy making efforts also on other FTAs, Vietnam, Japan, Singapore, Mercosur.
Yeah, I think this is a fantastic example. And it's, I have to confess that I have used some of those maps myself when I go to those websites and look at which companies in my region are exporting to the countries you mentioned. And I think it kind of combines two very powerful factors. The first is that all the politics is local. And the second is that you are effectively giving a voice to those who benefit from international trade, so they can gather around and also talk about the benefits of international trade and trade agreements. I think that's very powerful and it worked really well. So let's move on to the next question. I know you're interested in technology. You're very active in Twitter and you have tweeted about blockchain and the potential of this technology for international trade. I'm just wondering if you can tell us a bit more about what is that blockchain could actually bring to international trade, and also your views about the future of trade and trade policy more widely.
Yes, it's a fascinating topic, I find, and maybe my interest for technology comes from the fact that I have a dual degree. I am an engineer and an economist, so Perhaps that's how I get interested in the growing interface between a number of disruptive technologies and the way in which we should think about trade, and also some trade rules, actually, that may, in my view, may need some adaptation in order to remain relevant for the business community who is actually deploying these disruptive technologies, and rules need to be in sync with the new realities. What I was recently mentioning on social media, also to trigger interest from potential partners, was the fact that we have just launched a pilot project entitled EU Blockchain for Trade. You will find the hashtag on Twitter if you look for it. And the idea is to simply to be very open-minded at the moment. We know from a lot of theoretical research or a number of case studies that blockchain has a massive potential in many areas. It can be about the traceability of food. It could be about compliance with technical standards. It could be reassuring consumers that a certain standards we are very attached to are respected in the production process. It could be environmental. It could be, for instance, we have legislation on conflict minerals. We would like to ensure that if we buy an electronic product which has a number of very rare elements, which sometimes they are actually mined in conflict zones, we have legislation to incentivize our operators to avoid buying conflict minerals and then fuel conflict. So blockchain would allow that traceability to be technologically driven, to reduce cost and red tape, and to increase the confidence of consumers and people at large that we can actually enforce rules effectively. And I think with the new chief trade enforcement officer, at least to me, there is potential to enhance our ability to enforce rules by making use of the new technologies, and blockchain is one of them. There's a joke about statisticians who say, in God we trust, everyone else must bring the data. And I think we could say, in God we trust, everyone else, when you trade, must join a blockchain. And I think blockchain can do to international trade, particularly supply chains, which can be extremely complicated with many players around the world. It can bring to the supply chains the trust needed for regulators, for government officials, but also for final consumers that products shipped around the world, they comply with the norms and regulations as they should. So maybe blockchain will do this from factories to your families, from global factories to your families. We can actually trace products and ensure they really comply with the rules as they should.
Yes, indeed. I think there are a lot of potential. And yes, this capacity to record exchanges and put it into a record with data that cannot be changed back gives quite a lot of confidence and helps the traceability of goods. And so there is indeed quite a lot of potential. Let me also ask you about something you are known of. So you put forward this concept of the fifth mode of supply. And in fact, you have done quite a lot of work on trading services. And I was wondering, how do you see trading services going forward?
I'm glad that you've asked me about other areas which were very important for me and my team for many years. And we were fortunate to receive the support from other international organizations in order to push forward the agenda on trading services. In fact, if I look back at the last 10 years, I think one red thread that was common to all the things we did was to find the blind spots in our policy making and anticipate future challenges or opportunities. And trading services was, in an analytical sense, a bit of a blind spot. For almost a quarter of a century, for more than 25 years, we were negotiating rules affecting trading services. We had a negotiating platform and rules in FTAs or in the WTO, in the GATS, which were really defined by the so-called modes of supply. You can trade services in many ways, digitally, online, you can go abroad, et cetera, et cetera. So the problem was that in order to guide these negotiations, we did not have any statistics on trading services by mode of supply. In fact, in many respects, we were missing data on the most important mode of supply. GATS jargon is called mode 3. Is you invest abroad, open an office, and sell services as a foreign affiliate abroad.
Well, that kind of data was very frequently missing for a statistical anomaly, which is that that kind of data is not calculated and collected like the other ones. This is the biggest part. By our calculations nowadays, this is probably around 60% of all international trade in services. So the biggest mode of supply was missing in statistics, and there was no breakdown of the others. Now it's so crucial for us to know the value and the specificities of digital services, and yet we didn't have any data that comes near that kind of concept. So we started with the WTO and Eurostat and many others, a joint project to split and compensate for this mode of supply that is missing. And in the process, I've also realized that in reality, you can also sell services in a box, as I call them. This dichotomy between services and goods is no longer relevant from a business perspective. Many of our products are extremely sophisticated and rich in all kinds of embedded services. Think of your car, for instance. What would your car be without the design, without the engineering, without the software that controls everything and not just your infotainment? Software controls your brakes, the optimization of your engine. By many accounts, particularly for electric cars, services probably are accounting nowadays for more than 50% of the value of a sophisticated car. So in a way, these are services on wheels, but we put these services in containers, then they cross borders. And when they do so, very often, more often than not, these services pay custom duties. So this is what I call mode five. These are services that are embedded in a product, extremely important for the competitiveness of your industries. And yet, unfortunately, our trade rules do not promote the servicification of our manufacturing. So there is a lot for us to reflect upon and make sure that we improve the rules that affect the products of the future. Think of Internet of Things. Probably by then, the two worlds of the WTO, the GATT, the rule book for goods, and the GATS, the rule book for services, maybe they need a bridge between them. These are very important pillars in the WTO architecture. Unfortunately, there is no bridge between them. So my idea was to actually propose such a bridge through a little article in the Custom Valuation Agreement. So just for those who want to follow up on what I'm saying, just look for Article 8 in the Custom Valuation Agreement.
Yes, that's very right. And it is one of these examples where businesses have moved while the regulation is still catching up. Businesses develop products in a tough competitive environment. They add technology, they add innovation, which more often than not come from IT services, without thinking much about the certification of the economy, Mode 5, and the rules governing international trade.
Well, the rules that are governing embedded software were probably written on a typewriter.
That's very true. And I think that's something we all have to think about, and the WTO should also think about it. Lucian, you have mentioned that this is the end of your post as the chief trade economist in the e-trade. But you didn't talk about what is coming next. So what are your future plans, Lucian?
I still have a couple of days left and a few things to finish, and I'm frantically trying to give a good handover note to my successor. But I will start very soon a new chapter in my professional life, and I'm extremely excited to jump into two very complex trade policy related issues. I will be in charge of global regulatory cooperation, technical barriers to trade, and public procurement negotiations. So regulatory cooperation is very different from public procurement, except perhaps some occasional overlap. But I'm very familiar with these two different fields, and I'm glad that I can tap into parts of my career when I was very busy working on both of them. On non-tariff measures, for instance, I was part of the team that launched the first global repository of all the non-tariff measures affecting trade worldwide. It's an interagency effort led by UNCTAD, WTO, World Bank, and a few other agencies, UNIDO, etc. So the idea is that I will ensure that we do data-driven policymaking on TBTs and standards and regulatory cooperation. And similarly on international procurement, I spent the last 4 years being in charge of a massive project, which collected for the first time tens of millions of record of firm level transactions in public procurement in many markets. And that is something that we could very successfully use to calibrate our policy in public procurement negotiations in the future. In fact, I could end with something that I'm sure it's interested to many people since we still live in COVID times. These type of data, the firm level data we've been collecting also on the FTA comes to town or in this public procurement firm level data collection, has also been very surprisingly and unexpectedly extremely useful during the COVID pandemic. At the peak of the COVID pandemic, when hospitals and national health authorities around Europe were facing massive shortage of COVID-related materials, the European Commission stepped in and launched a sort of a force majeure joint procurement procedure. I'm sure if you've seen it around, we may try to make a lot of publicity for it to ensure that we have reply from many suppliers. But unfortunately, there was a fear and a risk that we wouldn't have enough suppliers who would send us an offer. We were not in the business of buying masks and ventilators before the crisis. So you would understand that we were not well versed in that procedure, despite very good colleagues in across the commission with expertise. So we used advanced text mining techniques together with our partners who helped us in these projects. And we identified dozens or even hundreds of additional suppliers for each of these categories in short supply, notably ventilators, COVID test kits, et cetera, et cetera. So we gave those names of firms to our colleagues who were in charge of the procurement process. And we were told that this firm level data was extremely useful in identifying additional suppliers, buying new quantities, making sure that we have this stockpiling that is now available at EU level. It's called Rescue. So I personally like to believe that this trade policy 2.0 saved a few extra lives in Europe.
Good. I think it's excellent news that you are going to work on these topics, which are extremely relevant for trade policy. Let me end with one final question. One of the last documents that you have published is titled Trade Policy Reflections Beyond the COVID-19 Outbreak. In the blog we published together in ESIP, we also discussed the vulnerability of global supply chains and its impact on EU imports. I was wondering if you could give us a few thoughts and ideas on this topic and how can we build a more resilient EU trade policy?
COVID pandemic was an unprecedented shock to the global trading system. Actually, a far bigger shock than any other disruptions we've seen in recent past. This also shows in our trade forecasts, which predicted a much more severe impact than the 2009 crisis, for instance. So the COVID pandemic indeed highlighted some vulnerabilities in our supply chains at the peak of the pandemic, at least, and we must address them in order to be better prepared for the future crisis. And I think that given the very detailed nature of such potential vulnerabilities, once again, we need a firm level trade policy 2.0 approach. In our blog, for instance, using the most detailed trade data available, we identified some 250 products potentially vulnerable out of over 9,000 products we import in Europe. These 250 products are actually less than 1% of our imports, so we're not talking about massive potential vulnerabilities. But that's not the end of the analysis. We shouldn't jump to conclusions. We need to deepen our analysis, combine this potential vulnerability with an idea about if whether a product is critical, and if so, for which supply chains, and also add to it a multifaceted risk assessment platform to be prepared for all kinds of global risks affecting supply chains. But I think what is so far obvious from this first assessment is that our supply chains, by and large, seem to be resilient. The EU imports the vast majority of our products from a wide range of alternative suppliers. And beyond international trade, we also can tap into the large potential of the single market. We have a very large, well-functioning single market with many potential suppliers. But be it as it may, we're all interested at the end of the day, policymakers and business leaders, to really strengthen and ensure the supply chains become more resilient. And for that, I think import diversification remains a viable strategy. And as we pointed out in our blog, SMEs should not be discarded, because I think SMEs can be an important element to ensure diversification and resilience in our supply chains.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is a topic that will drive the discussion going forward. And I think if diversification is a way of making our system more resilient, imports are also a way of diversifying our source of goods. So in a way, we kind of have another positive story on international trade there. So Lucien, let me thank you for these 10 years where you've done amazing work. You and your team have really made a difference on EU trade policy, and we all have benefit from these public goods that you have delivered and which we have been discussing today. And also, let's hope that before the start of your new activities as new head of unit working on global regulatory cooperation and international procurement, let's hope that you can take a well-deserved break over the summer. It's been a pleasure talking to you, Lucien, and thank you very, very much for being on Eastside Global Economy Podcast.
Thank you, Oscar, and I hope our listeners will also be able to take a well-deserved break. We're still facing challenges in terms of travel and safety and social distancing, but I think we are all in need for a period where we can recharge our batteries. We've been well tested by this COVID pandemic and the great lockdown. We had to work under difficult conditions, so that's what I also told my team. We need to take a break, stay with families, ensure that we are back again in September with new ideas and new energy for something that will be just as important, if not more important. We live in turbulent times globally when it comes to trade policy, and we need all hands on deck.
Fantastic. So thank you again, Lucien.